trail to Texas from Fort Smith, July pointed out. If I was looking for you, that's where I'd likely be.
Yeah, but I didn't know you was looking for me, Roscoe said. You don't usually.
Pete wrote and told me you was on the way, July said. It was all the explanation he planned to offer until he could get Roscoe alone.
I guess we're caught, but what next? Hutto asked. He did not like to be left out of conversations.
Jim, who still had to suck hard to get his breath, showed no inclination to talk.
You say there's a girl? July asked.
Yep, Janie.
Call her in, July said.
Roscoe made an effort, but it went awkwardly.
Come on, July's here,
he said loudly into the darkness.
It's safe. He's the sheriff I work for, he added just as loudly.
There was no sound from the darkness, no sign of Janie. Roscoe could tell July was impatient. It made him nervous. He remembered how Janie had disappeared for 2 hours that afternoon. If she thought July would wait 2 hours, she didn't know much about him.
Come on in! We got these men tied, he said, without much hope that Janie would obey.
She didn't. There was not a sound to be heard, except for some coyotes singing about a mile away.
I suspect that girl has Indian blood, Hutto said. She had us ambushed fair and square, and if she was as good with a pistol as she was with a rock, we'd be dead.
What's the matter with her, July asked. Why won't she come?
Well, I don't know, Roscoe said. She don't take to company, I guess.
July thought it a very odd business. Roscoe had never been one to womanize. In fact, around Fort Smith, his skill in avoiding various widow women had often been commented on, and yet he had somehow taken up with a girl who could throw rocks more accurately than most men could shoot.
I don't intend to spend the night here, July said. Has she got a horse?
No, but she's quick afoot, Roscoe said. She's been keeping ahead of me without no trouble. Where are we going?
To Fort Worth, July said. The sheriff there will probably be glad to get these men.
Yes, he will, the son of a bitch, Hutto said.
Roscoe felt bad about going off and leaving Janie, but he couldn't think what to do about it. July tied the two outlaws' horses to a single lead rope and instructed Roscoe and Joe to stay close behind them. It had clouded up and was almost pitch dark, but that had no effect on July's pace, which was fast. Having to deliver the outlaws to justice was taking him out of his way, and there was nothing else for it. When they had been riding about an hour, Roscoe got the scare of his life. Suddenly, someone jumped on the horse behind him. For a terrifying second, he thought Jim must have gotten loose and come to strangle him or stick a knife in him. Memphis was startled, too, and jumped sideways into Joe's horse. Then he heard the person panting, and he knew it was Janie.
I couldn't keep up no longer, she said. I thought he'd slow down, but he just keeps going.
Joe was so startled to see a girl materialize behind Roscoe that he didn't say a word. He found it hard to credit that the person who had thrown the rocks could be a girl. Yet he had seen the rocks hit the men. How could a girl throw so hard and straight? July had appropriated Hutto's shotgun, loaded it, and put it across his saddle. He assumed it would make the prisoners think twice before starting trouble. His one thought was to get back to Fort Worth, turn the men over, and start at once to look for Elmira. They rode all night, and when the plains got gray, they were no more than 5 miles from Fort Worth. He glanced back at the prisoners and was startled to see the girl riding behind Roscoe. She looked very young. Her bare legs were as thin as a bird's. Roscoe was slumped over the horn, asleep, and the girl held the reins. She was also watching the two prisoners, both of whom were plenty wide awake. July got down and checked Hutto's knots, which indeed were slipping.
"I guess you're Janie," he said to the girl. She nodded.
July handed her the shotgun to hold while he retied Hutto.
"Ay, God, don't do that. She's apt to cut us in two," Jim said. His voice had a husky croak from the blow on his throat. It pained him to speak, but the sight of the girl with the shotgun clearly pained him more. Joe had managed to get the sleep out of his eyes and was rather aggrieved that July had given the gun to the girl. She was no older than he was, and she was a female. He felt he ought to have been given the shotgun.
"You don't give a man much of a chance, do you?" Hutto said as July retied him.
He was a messy sight from all the dried blood on his mouth and his beard, but he seemed cheerful.
"Nope," July said.
"Well, if they don't hang us, you better watch out for Jim," Hutto said. "Jim hates to have anyone point a gun at him. He's got a vengeful nature, too."
Jim did seem vengeful. His eyes were shining with hatred, and he was looking at the girl. The look was so hot that many men would have flinched from it, but the girl didn't. All the while, Roscoe slumped over his horse's neck, snoring away. They were nearly on the outskirts of Fort Worth before he woke up, and it was not until July handed the prisoners over to the sheriff that he began to feel alive. Janie had acted like she wanted to bolt when they came into town. The sight of so many wagons and people clearly upset her, but she held on. July found a livery stable, for it would be necessary to rest the horses for a while. It was run by a woman who kindly offered to scrape up a little breakfast for the youngsters. It consisted of cornbread and bacon, which they ate sitting on big washtubs outside the woman's house. Roscoe's clothes were practically in ribbons, so much so that the woman laughed when she saw him. She offered to mend his clothes for another 50 cents, but Roscoe had to decline, since he had nothing to wear while the work was being done.
"This is a big-looking town," Roscoe said. "I guess I can buy myself some clothes."
"Not for no 50 cents," the woman said. "That's nothing but a sack the girl's wearing. You ought to get her something decent to wear while you're buying."
"Well, I might," Roscoe said.
It was true that Janie's dress was a mere rag. Janie seemed to think Fort Worth was quite a sight. She was over her fright, and she looked around with interest.
"Is that girl your daughter?" the woman asked.
"No," Roscoe said. "I never saw her until last week."
"Well, she's somebody's daughter, and she deserves better than a sack to wear," the woman said. "That boy dresses all right. How come you skimped on the girl?"
"No opportunity," Roscoe said. "I just found her up in the country."
The woman had a red face, and it got redder when she was angry, as she now clearly was. "I don't know what to think of you men," she said, and went into her house and slammed the door.
"Where did you get her?" July asked.
"I didn't get her, exactly," Roscoe said. He felt on the defensive. It was clear that people would think the worst of him, whatever he did. No doubt in Fort Smith the word would be out that instead of sticking to orders, he had run off with the first young girl he could find. "Well, she run off and followed me," he added.
July looked noncommittal.
"A darn old man beat her and used her hard. That's why she run off," Roscoe elaborated. "Can we go to a saloon? I'd sure fancy a beer."
July took him to a saloon and bought him a beer. Now that he had Roscoe alone, he felt curiously reluctant to mention Elmira. Even hearing her name spoken would be painful.
"What about Ellie?" he said finally. "Peach said she left."
"Well, Peach is right," Roscoe said. "Or if she didn't leave, then she's hiding, or else a bear got her."
"Did you see bear tracks?" July asked.
"No,"
Roscoe admitted.
"Then a bear didn't get her," July said.
"She probably left on the whiskey boat,"
Roscoe said, trying to hide behind his beer glass.
"I don't see why," July said softly, almost to himself. He didn't see why. He had never done anything to disturb her that he could remember. He had never hit her or even spoken harshly to her.
What would prompt a woman to run off when nothing was wrong? Of course it wasn't true that nothing had been wrong. Something had been. He just didn't know what. He didn't know why she had married him if she didn't like him, and he had the sense that she didn't. It was true that Peach had hinted a few times that people got married for reasons other than liking, but Peach was known to be cynical. Now, in the saloon, he remembered Peach's hints. Maybe Ellie had never liked him. Maybe she had married him for reasons she hadn't wanted to mention. Thinking about it made him feel very sad. "Did you talk to her at all after I left?" he asked Roscoe. "No," Roscoe admitted. July didn't speak for 5 minutes. Roscoe turned over in his mind various excuses for not seeing Elmira, but in truth it had never once occurred to him to go and see her. He slowly drank his beer. "What about Jake?" he asked. "He's to the south," July said. "He's coming with a trail herd. I want to find Ellie. Once that's done, we'll look for Jake." He fished some money out of his pocket and paid for the beers. "Maybe you ought to take the young ones and go back to Arkansas," he said. "I'm going after Ellie."
"I'll come with you," Roscoe said.
Now that he had found July, he had no intention of losing him again. He had had plenty of trouble coming, and yet worse might occur if he tried to go back on his own. "I expect if we paid that woman, she'd board the girl," July said. "You go buy some duds. You'll be a laughingstock if you try and travel on those you got on." The woman at the livery stable agreed to board Janie for $3 a month. July paid for 2 months. When told that she was to stay in Fort Worth, Janie didn't say a word. The woman spoke to her cheerfully about getting some better clothes, but Janie sat on the washtub, silent. The woman offered to take Joe, too, and board him free if he would help out around the livery stable. July was tempted, but Joe looked so unhappy that he relented and decided to let him stay with him. Then Roscoe showed up, in clothes that looked so stiff it was a wonder he could even walk in them.
"I guess you might break them clothes in by Christmas," the livery stable woman said, laughing. "You look like you're wearing stovepipes." "I can't help it if they're black," Roscoe said. "It was all they had that fit."
He felt sorry about leaving Janie. What if old Sam got well and tracked them to Fort Worth and found her? He offered her $2 in case she had expenses. But Janie just shook her head. When they rode off, she was still sitting on the big washtub. Joe was glad she wasn't coming. She made him feel that he didn't do things very well. He didn't have long to enjoy being glad, though. That night, they camped on the plains, 20 miles north of Fort Worth. July felt it was all right to sleep without a guard, as there were trail herds on both sides of them. They could hear the night herders singing to the cattle. In the morning, when Joe opened his eyes, Janie was squatted by the cold campfire. She still wore her sack. Even July had not heard her come. When July woke up, she handed him back the $6 he had given the woman. July just took it, looking surprised. Joe felt annoyed. It was wrong of the girl to come without July's permission. If the Indians carried her off, he, for one, would not be too sorry, although, when he thought about it, he realized he himself might be an easier catch. The girl had followed them at night, across the plains. It was something that he couldn't have done. All that day the girl ran along on her own, never getting far behind. She was not like any of the girls Joe had known in Fort Smith, none of whom could have kept up for 5 minutes. Joe didn't know what to make of her, and neither did July, or even Roscoe, who had found her. But they soon were far out on the plains, and it was clear to everyone that Janie was along for the trip.
Chapter 53.
Long before the whiskey boat stopped, Elmira knew she was going to have trouble with Biggs Way. The man had never approached her, or even spoken to her. But every time she went out of her shed to sit and watch the water, she felt his eyes on her. and when they loaded the whiskey in the wagons and started across the plains for Bent's fort, his eyes followed her in whatever wagon she chose to ride for the day. It seemed to her it might be the fact that she was so small that made Big Zway so interested. It was a problem she had had before. Huge men seemed to like her because she was so tiny. Big Zway was even larger than the buffalo hunter who had caused her to run to July. Sometimes in the evening, when he brought her food, Fowler would sit and talk with her a bit. He had a scar which ran over his nose and down across his lips into his beard. He had a rough look, but his eyes were dreamy.
"This whiskey-hauling business is about petered out," he said one evening. "Indians kept the trade going. Now they've got 'em all penned up down in these parts. I may go up north."
"Are there many towns up north?" she asked, remembering that Dee had mentioned going north. Dee liked his comforts, hotels and barber shops and such. Once she had offered to cut his hair and had made a mess of it. Dee had been good-natured about it, but he did remark that it paid to stick to professionals. He was vain about his looks.
"There's Ogallala," Fowler said. "That's on the Platte. There's towns in Montana, but that's a long way."
Big Zway had a deep voice. She could sometimes hear him talking to the men, even over the creak of the wagon wheels. He wore a long buffalo coat and seldom took it off, even when the days were hot. One morning there was great excitement. Just as the morning mist began to thin, the man on guard claimed to have seen 6 Indians on a ridge. He was a young man, very nervous. If there were Indians, they did not reappear. During the day, the men surprised 3 buffalo and killed one of them. That night, Fowler brought Elmira samples of the liver and the tongue, the best parts, he said. The men had talked about the fort so much that Elmira had supposed it was a real town, but it was just a few scattered buildings, none in good repair. There was only one woman there, the wife of a blacksmith, and she had gone crazy due to the death of all 5 of her children. She sat in a chair all day, saying nothing to anyone. Fowler did his best for Elmira. He got the traders to let her have a little room, just a tiny, dirty closet, really. It was next to a warehouse where piles of buffalo skins were stored. The smell of the skins was worse than anything that had happened on the river. Her room was full of fleas that had escaped from the skins. She spent much of her time scratching. Though the fort was nothing much to see, it was a busy place, with riders coming and going all the time. Watching them, Elmira wished that she was a man so she could just buy a horse and ride away. The men let her alone, but they did look at her whenever she left her room. There were several wild-looking Mexicans who scared her worse than the buffalo hunters. After a week of scratching, she began to realize she had done a foolish thing, taking the whiskey boat. In Fort Smith, all she had felt was an overwhelming desire to go. The day she left, she felt that her life depended on getting out of Fort Smith that day. She had a fear that July would suddenly show up again. She didn't regret leaving, but neither did she calculate on landing in a place as bad as Bent's Fort. In the cow town, stages came and went, at least. If you didn't like Dodge, you could always go to Abilene, but no stage came to Bent's Fort, just a wagon track that soon disappeared into the emptiness of the plains. Though she had not been bothered, the men of the fort looked very rough. "They don't think you're worth robbing," Fowler said, but she wasn't sure he was right. Some of the Mexicans looked like they might do worse than rob her if the mood struck them. Once, sitting under the little shed outside her room, she saw a fight between 2 Mexicans. She heard a yell and saw each man pull a knife. They went at one another like butchers. Their clothes were soon bloody, but evidently their cuts were not serious, for after a while they stopped fighting and went back to gambling together. Fowler said there might be a party of hunters going north, and that perhaps they would take her, but a week passed and the party didn't materialize. Then one day Fowler brought her a little plate of food under her shed. He looked at her sheepishly, as if he had something to say but didn't want to say it.
Big Zway wants to marry you, he said finally, in an apologetic tone.
Well, I'm already married, she said.
What if he just wants to marry you temporary? Fowler asked.
It's always temporary, Elmira said. Why don't he ask himself?
Zway ain't much of a talker, Fowler said.
I've heard him talk, she said. He talks to the men. Fowler laughed and said no more. Elmira felt angry. She was in a spot if some man was wanting to marry her. Someone had thrown a fresh buffalo skin into the warehouse, and she could hear the flies buzzing on it from where she sat.
He'll take you to Ogallala, if you'll do it, Fowler said. You might think about it. He ain't as bad as some.
How would you know, she asked. You ain't been married to him.
Fowler shrugged.
He might be your best bet, he said. I'm going back downriver next week. A couple of hide haulers are taking a load to Kansas. They might take you, but it'd be a hard trip. You'll have to smell them stinking hides all the way. Anyway, the hide haulers are rough, he said. I think Zway would treat you all right.
I don't want to go to Kansas, she said. I've been to Kansas. What ruined that was that she was pregnant and showing. Some of the saloons weren't particular, but it was always harder to get work if you were pregnant. Besides, she didn't want to work. She wanted Dee, who wouldn't mind that she was pregnant. Big Zway began to spend hours just watching her. She sat under her shed in one patch of shade, and he sat in another about 30 yards away, just watching. He didn't pretend to gamble or do anything else. Once when he was watching, some riders spotted a little herd of buffalo. The other hunters were wild to go after him, but Zway wouldn't go. They yelled at him and argued with him, but he just sat. Finally, they went off without him. One hunter tried to borrow his gun, but Zway wouldn't give it up. He sat there with his big rifle across his lap, looking at Elmira. It became amusing to her, her power over the man. He had never spoken to her, not one word, and yet he would sit for hours 30 yards away. It was something. What must go through men's minds where women were concerned, to cause them to behave so strangely? One morning she came out of her closet earlier than usual. She had a touch of morning sickness and wanted some fresh air. When she opened the door, she almost bumped into Big Zway, who had just been standing outside her door. Her sudden appearance embarrassed him so that he gave her one appalled look and turned and went off, practically at a trot, putting a safe distance between them. He was a very heavy man, and the sight of him trying to run made her laugh out loud, something she hadn't done in a while. He didn't turn to look back at her again until he was safely back in his spot, and then he turned fearfully, as if he expected to be shot for having stood by her door. Tell him I'll go, she said to Fowler that evening. I guess he ain't so bad.
You tell him, Fowler said.
The next morning she walked over to where Big Zway sat. When he saw her coming, it seemed for a second like he might bolt, but she was too close. Instead, he sat as if paralyzed, fear in his eyes.
I'll go if you think you can get me to Ogallala, she said. I'll pay you what it's worth to you.
Zway didn't say anything.
How will we travel? She asked. I ain't much good at riding horses.
Big Zway didn't respond for about a minute. Elmira was about to lose patience when he brushed his mouth with the back of his hand as if to clean it.
Could get that there hide wagon, he said, pointing to a run-down piece of equipment a few yards away.
To Elmira, the wagon didn't look like it could travel 10 yards, much less all the way to Nebraska.
Could get the blacksmith to fix it,
Big Zway said. Now that he had spoken to her and not been struck by lightning, he felt a little easier.
Did you mean just us two to go? Elmira asked.
The question gave him so much pause that she almost wished he hadn't asked it. He fell silent again. His eyes troubled.
Might take Luke, he said. Luke was a weaselly little buffalo hunter with only a thumb and one finger on his left hand. He carried dice and gambled when he could get anyone to gamble with him. Once on the boat, she had asked Fowler about him, and Fowler said a butcher had cut his fingers off with a cleaver for some reason. "When can we go?" she asked. It turned out to be a decision Big Zway wasn't immediately up to making. He pondered the matter for some time, but reached no conclusion. "I want to get out of here," she said. "I'm tired of smelling these buffalo hides." "Get that blacksmith to fix that wagon," Zway responded. He stood up, picking up the tongue of the wagon, and began to drag it toward the blacksmith shop, 100 yards away. The next morning, the wagon, more or less patched, was sitting outside her closet. When she walked over to inspect it, she saw that Luke was in it, sleeping off a drunk. He slept with his mouth open, showing black teeth, and not many of them at that. Luke had ignored her on the trip upriver, but when he woke up, he hopped out of the wagon and came right over, a grin on his weaselly face. "Big Zway and I have partnered up," he said. "You drive a wagon?" "I guess I could if we go slow," she said. Luke had spiky red hair that stuck out in all directions. A skinning knife, a foot long, was slung in a scabbard under one shoulder. He grinned constantly, exposing his black teeth, and unlike Zway, was not a bit afraid to look her in the eye. He had an insolent manner and spat tobacco juice constantly while he talked. "Zway went to buy some mules," he said. "We got 2 horses, but they won't do for the wagon. Anyway, we might get some hides while you're driving the wagon." "I don't like the smell of hides," she said pointedly, but not pointedly enough for Luke to get the message. "You get to where you don't smell them after a while," he said. "I don't hardly even notice it. I've smelled them so much." Luke had a little quirk and was always nervously popping himself on the leg with it. "He's scared to Indians?" he asked. "I don't know," Elmira said. "I guess I don't like them much." "I've already killed 5 of them," Luke said. Big Zway finally arrived leading 2 scrawny mules and carrying a harness that he had traded for. The harness was in bad repair, but there was plenty of rawhide around, and they soon had it tied together fairly well. Luke was quite dexterous with his thumb and little finger. He did better than Zway, whose hands were too big for harness-making. She soon got the hang of driving the mules. There was not much to it, for the mules were content to follow the 2 men on horseback. It was only when the men loped off to hunt that the mules were likely to balk. On the 2nd day out, with the men gone, she crossed a creek whose banks were so steep and rough that she felt sure the wagon would turn over. She was ready to jump and take her chances, but by a miracle it stayed upright. That day the men killed 20 buffalo. Elmira had to wait in the sun all day while they skinned them out. Finally she got down and sat under the wagon, which provided a little shade. The men piled the bloody, smelly hides onto the wagon, which didn't suit the mules. They hated the smell of hides as much as she did. Big Zway had lapsed back into silence, leaving all the talking to Luke, who chattered away whether anybody was listening to him or not. Often Elmira had a nervous stomach. The jostling of the wagon took getting used to. The plains looked smooth in the distance, but they were surprisingly rough to pass over. Big Zway had given her a blanket to put over the rough seat. It kept her from getting splinters, but didn't cushion the bumps. Alone with the 2 men in the middle of the great, empty prairie, she felt apprehensive. In the cow towns, there had been lots of girls around. If a man had gotten mean, she could yell. On the boat, it hadn't seemed as dangerous, because the men were always fighting and gambling among themselves. But at night on the prairie, there were only the 3 of them, and nothing much to keep anyone busy. Big Zway sat and looked at her through the campfire, and Luke looked, too, while he talked. She didn't know if Big Zway considered that in some way he married her already. She worried that he might suddenly come over and want the marriage to begin. though so far he had been too shy even to speak to her much. For all she knew, he might expect her to be married to Luke, too. And she didn't want that. The thought made her so nervous that she couldn't eat the buffalo meat they offered her. Anyway, it was tougher than any meat she had ever tried to chew. She chewed on one bite until her jaws got tired and then spat it out. But when she went to the wagon and made the one blanket into a kind of bed, neither man followed. She lay awake for a long time, apprehensive, but the men sat by the fire, occasionally looking at her, but making no move to disturb her. Luke got his dice out, and soon they were playing. Elmira was able to sleep, but awoke to the roll of thunder a few hours later. The men were asleep by the dying fire. Across the prairie she began to see lightning darting down the sky. And within a few minutes big drops of water hit her. In a minute she was wet. She jumped down and crawled under the wagon. It wasn't much protection, but it was some. Soon the lightning was crashing all around, and the thunder came in big, flat cracks, as if a building had fallen down. It frightened her so that she hugged her knees and trembled. When the lightning struck, the whole prairie would be bathed for a second in white light. The rainstorm soon passed, but she lay awake for the rest of the night, listening to the water drip off the wagon. It grew very dark. She didn't know what might have happened to the men. But in the morning, they were right where they had gone to sleep, wet as muskrats, but ready to drink a pot of coffee. Neither even commented on the storm. Elmira decided that they were used to hard traveling, and that she had better get used to it, too. Soon she began to talk to the mules as they plodded along. She didn't say much, and the mules didn't answer, but it made the long, hot days pass a little faster.
Chapter 54
Augustus spent half the first day finding the tracks, for Blue Duck had been cool enough to lead Lorena through the stampeding cattle, so that their tracks would be blotted out by the thousands of cattle tracks. It was a fine trick, and one not many men would dare to try. Years had passed since Augustus had done any serious tracking. He rode around all morning, trying to remember the last man he had tracked, just to give himself perspective. It seemed to him that the last man had been an incompetent horse thief named Webster Witter, who had rustled horses in the Blanco country at one time. He and Call had gone after him one day by themselves and caught him and hung him before sundown, but the tracking had been elemental, due to the fact that the man had been driving 40 stolen horses. The thing he remembered best about Webster Witter was that he had been a tall man, and they caught him out in the scrub and had to hang him to a short tree. It was that or take him back, and Call was against taking him back. Call believed summary justice was often the only justice, and in those days he was right, since they had to depend on circuit judges who, often as not, didn't show up. If we take him back, he'll bribe the jailer or dig out or something. And we'll have to catch him at it again, Call said. It never occurred to Call to just shoot someone he could hang. And in this instance, Augustus didn't suggest it, for they had rushed out without much ammunition and were traveling in rough country. Fortunately, Webster's neck broke when they whipped the horse out from under him. Otherwise, he would have stood there and laughed at them, for the limb of the mesquite sagged badly and both his feet drug the ground. That had been at least 12 years ago, and Augustus soon concluded that his tracking skills had rusted to the point of being unusable. The only horse tracks he found for the first 3 hours belonged to the Hat Creek horses. He almost decided to go back and get Dietz, though he knew Call would be reluctant to surrender him. Finally, by circling wide to the northwest, Augustus crossed the three horses' tracks. Blue Duck had tried the one trick, crossing the stampede, but that was all. After that, the tracks bore straight for the northwest, so unerringly that Augustus soon found he didn't need to pay much attention to them. If he lost them, he could usually pick them up within a half a mile. He rode as hard as he dared, but he had only one horse and couldn't afford to ruin him. At each watering, he let him have a few minutes of rest. He rode all night, and the next day the tracks were still bearing northwest. He felt unhappy with himself, for he wasn't catching up. Lorena was getting a taste of hard travel, the like of which she had never imagined. Probably she would have worse to deal with than hard travel unless she was very lucky, and Augustus knew that it was his fault. He should have packed her into camp the minute he discovered who Blue Duck was. In retrospect, he couldn't imagine why he hadn't. It was the kind of lapse he had been subject to all his life. Things that were clearly dangerous didn't worry him enough. He tried to swallow his regrets and concentrate on finding her. After all, it had happened, and why he had let it no longer particularly mattered. Blue Duck was a name from their past. Having him show up in their midst 15 years later had thrown his reasoning off. A second day he stopped tracking altogether, since it was plain Blue Duck was heading for the Staked Plains. That took in a lot of territory, of course, but Augustus thought he knew where Blue Duck would go, to an area north and west of Palo Duro Canyon. It was there he had always retreated when pursued. Once Colin he had sat on the western edge of the Great Canyon, looking across the brown, waterless distances to the west. They had finally decided to end their pursuit there, while they had a fair chance of getting back alive. It wasn't Indians they feared so much as lack of water. It had been midsummer, and the plains looked seared. What grass there was, brown and brittle. Col was frustrated. He hated to turn back before he caught his man. "There's got to be water out there," Col said. "They cross it, and they can't drink dirt." "Yes, but they know where it is, and we don't," Augustus pointed out. "They can kill their horses getting to it. They got more horses. But if we kill ours, it's a darn long walk back to San Antonio." That afternoon, he crossed the Clear Fork of the Brazos, past a half-built cabin, abandoned and empty. It was a vivid enough reminder of the power of the Comanches. Their massacres caused plenty of settlers to retreat while they still had legs to retreat on. Colin he had watched through the 50s as the line of the frontier advanced only to collapse soon after. The men and women who came up the Trinity and the Brazos were no strangers to hardship, but the hardship was one thing, terror another. The land was spacious and theirs for the taking, but the land couldn't cancel out fear, a fact that Col never understood. It annoyed him that the whites gave up and retreated. "I wish they'd stick," he said many times. "If they would, there'd soon be enough of them to beat back the Indians." "You ain't never laid in a bed all night with a scared woman," Augustus said. "You can't start a farm if you've got to live in a fort. Them that starts the farms have got to settle off by themselves, which means they're easy to cut off and carve up." "Well, they could leave the women for a while," Col said. "Send for 'em when it's safe." "Yes, but a man that goes to the trouble to take a wife don't generally want to go off and leave her," Augustus pointed out. "It means doing the chores all by yourself. Besides, without a wife handy, you won't be getting no kids, and kids are a wonderful source of free labor. They're cheaper than slaves by a damn sight." They had argued the point for years, but fruitlessly, for Col had no sympathy for human weakness. Augustus put it down to a lack of imagination. Col could never imagine what it was like to be scared. They had been in tight spots, but usually that meant action. And in battles, things happened too fast for fear to paralyze the mind of a man like Col. He couldn't imagine what it was like to go to bed every night scared that you and your family would feel the knives of the Comanches before sunrise. That night, Augustus stopped to rest his horse, making a cold camp on a little bluff and eating some jerky he had brought along. He was in the scrubby post-oak country near the Brazos, and from his bluff he could see far across the moonlit valleys. It struck him that he had forgotten emptiness such as existed in the country that stretched around him. After all, for years he had lived within the sound of the piano from the dry bean, and the sound of the church bell in the little lonesome dove church, the sound of Bowl whacking the dinner bell. He even slept within the sound of P.I.'s snoring, which was as regular as the ticking of a clock. But here there was no sound, not any. The coyotes were silent, the crickets, the locusts, the owls. There was only the sound of his own horse grazing. From him to the stars in all directions, there was only silence and emptiness, not the talk of men over their cards, nothing.
Though he had ridden hard, he felt strangely rested, just from the silence. The next day he found the carcass of Lori's mare. By the end of the day he was out of the scrub. When he crossed the Wichita, he angled west. He had not seen Blue Duck's tracks in 2 days, but he didn't care. He had always had confidence in his instincts and felt he knew where the man would stop. Possibly he was bound for Adobe Walls, one of the Bents' old forts. This one, on the Canadian, had never been much of a success. The Bents had abandoned it, and it became a well-known gathering place for buffalo hunters, as well as for anyone crossing the plains. It was spring. What few buffalo were left would be moving north, and what buffalo hunters were left would be gathered at the old fort, getting ready for a last hide harvest. Buffalo hunters were not known to be too particular about their company. Though Blue Duck and his men had picked off plenty of them over the years, the new crop would probably overlook that fact if he turned up with a prize like Lorena. Also, there were still renegade bands of Kiowas and Comanches loose on the plains. The bands were supposedly scattered. At least that was the talk in South Texas, and the trade in captives virtually dead. But Augustus wasn't in South Texas anymore, and as he rode through the empty country, he had plenty of time to consider that maybe the talk hadn't been all that accurate. Talk often wasn't. The bands were doomed, but they might last another year or two, whereas he was advancing into their country in the here and now. He wasn't afraid for himself, but he was afraid for Lorena. Blue Duck might be dealing with some renegade chief with a taste for white women. Lorena would put a nice cap on a career largely devoted to stealing children. If Blue Duck intended to trade her to an Indian, he would probably take her farther west, through the region known as the Quitaqua, and then north to a crossing on the Canadian where the Comanches had traded captives for decades. Nearby was the famous Valley of Tears, spoken of with anguish by such captives as had been recovered. There the Comancheros divided captives, mothers being separated from their children and sold to different bands, the theory being that if they were isolated, they would be less likely to organize escapes. As he moved into the Quitaqua, a parched country where shallow red canyons stretched west toward the Palo Duro, Augustus would see little spiraling dust devils rising from the exposed earth far ahead of him. During the heat of the day, mirages in the form of flat lakes appeared, so vivid that a time or two he almost convinced himself that there was water ahead, although he knew there wasn't. He decided to head first for the big crossing on the Canadian. If there was no sign of Blue Duck there, he could always follow the river over to the walls. He crossed the Prairie Dog Fork of the Red River. Plenty of prairie dogs were in evidence, too, and rode west to the edge of the Palo Duro. Several times he saw small herds of buffalo, and twice rode through the valleys of bleached bones, places where hunters had slaughtered several hundred animals at a time. By good luck, he found a spring and spent the night by it, resting his horse for the final push. Late the next day, he came into the breaks of the Canadian, a country of shallow, eroded gullies. They could see where the river curved east, across the plains. He rode east for several miles, hoping to cross Blue Duck's tracks. He didn't, which convinced him he had guessed wrong in coming so far west. The man had probably gone directly to the walls and pitched Lorena into the laps of a bunch of buffalo hunters. Before he had time to lament his error, though, Augusta saw a sight which took his mind off it completely. He saw a speck moving across the plains north toward the river. At first he thought it might be Blue Duck. But if so, he was traveling without Lorena. There was only one speck. His horse saw the speck, too. Augustus drew his rifle in case the speck turned out to be hostile. He loped toward it, only to discover an old man with a dirty white beard pushing a wheelbarrow across the plains. The wheelbarrow contained buffalo bones, and as if that wasn't unusual enough, Augustus found that he even knew the man. His name was Os Frank, and he had started as a mountain man, trapping beaver. He had once kept a store in Waco, but for some reason got mad and robbed a bank next to his store. The bank had thought they were getting along with him fine until the day he walked in and robbed them.
Augustus and Call were in Waco at the time, and though Call was reluctant to bother with bank robbers, he felt bankers were so stupid they deserved robbing. They were persuaded to go after him. They caught him right away, but not without a gun battle. The battle took place in a thicket on the Brazos, where Os Frank had stopped to cook some venison. It went on for 2 hours and resulted in no injuries. Then Os Frank ran out of ammunition and had been easy enough to arrest. He cursed them all the way back to Waco and broke out of jail the day they left town. Augustus had not heard of him since, yet there he was, wheeling a barrel full of buffalo bones across the high plains. He didn't seem to be armed, so Augustus rode right up to him, keeping his rifle across the saddle. The old robber could well have a pistol hidden in the bones, though unless his aim had improved, he was not much of a threat, even if he did. "Hello, Os," Augustus said as he rode up. "Have you gone into bone business or what?" The old man squinted at him for a moment, but made no reply. He kept on wheeling his barrel full of bones over the rough ground. Tobacco drippings had stained his beard until most of it was a deep brown. "I guess you don't remember me," Augustus said, falling in beside him. "I'm Captain McCrae. We shot at one another all afternoon once, up on the Brazos. You was in one thicket, and me and Captain Call was in the next one. We pruned the post oaks with all that shooting, and then we stuck you in jail, and you crawled right out again." "I don't like you much," Os Frank said, still trundling. "Put me in the goddamn jail." "Well, why'd you rob that bank?" Augustus said. "It ain't Christian to rob your neighbors. It ain't Christian to hold a grudge, neither. Wasn't you born into the Christian religion?" "No," Os Frank said. "What do you want?" "White girl," Augustus said. "Pretty one. Outlaw carried her off. You may know him. His name is Blue Duck." Os Frank stopped the wheelbarrow. He needed to spit and leaned over and spat a large mouthful of tobacco juice directly into the hole of a red ant bed. The ants, annoyed, scurried about in all directions. Augustus laughed. Os Frank had always been an original. In Waco, as he remembered, he had caused controversy because he never seemed to sleep. The lantern in his store would be on at all hours of the night, and the man would often be seen roaming the streets at 3 in the morning. Nobody knew what he was looking for, or if he found it. "Now that's a new trick," Augustus said. "Spitting on ants. I guess that's all you got to do besides haul bones." Os Frank resumed his walk, and Augustus followed along, amused at the strange turns life took. Soon they came down into the valley of the Canadian. Augustus was amazed to see an enormous pyramid of buffalo bones, perhaps 50 yards from the water. The bones were piled so high it seemed to him Os Frank must have a ladder to use in his piling, though he saw no sign of one. Down on the river, a quarter of a mile, there was another pyramid, just as large. "Well, Os, I see you've been busy," Augustus said. "You'll be so rich one of these days some bank will come along and rob you. Who do you sell these bones to?" Os Frank ignored the question. While Augustus watched, he pushed his wheelbarrow up to the bottom of the pyramid of bones and began to throw the bones as high as possible up on the pyramid. Once or twice he got a leg bone or a thigh bone all the way to the top, but most of the bones hit midway and stuck. In 5 minutes the big wheelbarrow was empty. Without a word, Os Frank took the wheelbarrow and started back across the prairie. Augustus decided to rest while the old man worked. Such camp as there was rudimentary. Os had dug a little cave in one of the red bluffs south of the river, and his gear was piled in front of it. There was a buffalo gun and a few pots and pans, and that was it. The main crossing was a mile downriver, and Augustus rode down to inspect it before unsaddling. There were horse tracks galore, but not those he was looking for. He saw 5 pyramids of bones between the crossing and Os Frank's camp, each containing several tons of bones. Back at the camp, Augustus rested in the shade of the little bluff.
Os Frank continued to haul bones until sundown. After pitching his last load up on the pyramid, he wheeled the barrow to his camp, turned it over, and sat on it. He looked at Augustus for 2 or 3 minutes without saying anything.
"Well, are you going to invite me for supper or not?" Augustus asked.
"Never should have arrested me," Os Frank said. "I don't like that goddamn bank."
"You didn't stay in jail but 4 hours," Augustus reminded him. "Now that I've seen how hard you work, I'd say you probably needed a rest. You could have studied English or something. I see you've learned it, finally."
"I don't like that goddamn bank," Os repeated.
"Let's talk about something else," Augustus suggested. "You're just lucky you didn't get shot on account of that bank. Me and Carl were both fine shots in those days. The thicket was the only thing that saved you."
"They cheated me because I couldn't talk good," Os Frank said.
"You got a one-track mind, Os," Augustus said. "You and half of mankind. How long you been up here on the Canadian River?"
"I come here 5 years," Os said. "I want a store."
"That's fine, but you've outrun the people," Augustus said. "They won't be along for another 10 years or so. I guess by then you'll have a hell of a stock of buffalo bones. I just hope there's a demand for them."
"Had a wagon," Os said. "Got stole. Apache's got it."
"That's so," Augustus said. "I didn't know the Apaches lived around here."
"Over by the Pecos," Os said. "I quit the mountains. Don't like snow."
"I'll pass on snow myself when I have the option," Augustus said. "This is a lonely place you've settled in, though. Don't the Indians bother you?"
"They leave me be," Os said. "That one you're hunting, he's a mean one. He killed Bob, built a fire under him, and let him sizzle. He don't bother me, though," he added. "Killed Bob and let me be."
"Bob who?"
"Old Bob. I was in the mountains with," Os said.
"Well, his burning days are over if I find him," Augustus said.
"He's quick, Blue Duck," Os said. "He has some Kiowas with him. They ate my dog."
"How many Kiowas?" Augustus asked.
"It was a big dog," Os said. "Killed 2 wolves. I had a few sheep once, but the Mexicans run them off."
"It's a chancy life out here on the plains," Augustus said. "I bet you get a nice breeze in the winter, too."
"Them Kiowas ate that dog," Os repeated. "Good dog."
"Why ain't Blue Duck killed you?" Augustus asked.
"Laughs at me," Os said. "Laughs at my bones. He says he'll kill me when he gets ready."
"How many Kiowas does he run around with?" Augustus asked again.
The old man was evidently not used to having anyone to talk to. His remarks came out a little jerky. 6, Os Frank said.
"Who's over at the walls?" Augustus asked.
The old man didn't answer. Darkness had fallen, and Augustus could barely see him sitting on his wheelbarrow. "No beaver in this river," Os Frank said after several minutes.
"No beaver'd be foolish enough to be in this river," Augustus said. "There ain't a tree within 20 miles, and beavers like to gnaw trees. You should have stayed up north if you like beavers."
"I'd rather gather these bones," the old man said. "You don't have to get your feet wet."
"Did you get to Montana when you was a beaver man?"
Augustus waited several minutes for a reply, but the old man never answered. When the moon came up, Augustus saw that he had fallen asleep sitting on his wheelbarrow, his head fallen over in his arms. Augustus was tired and hungry. He lay where he was, thinking about food, but making no effort to get up and fix any, if there was any to be fixed. While he was thinking he ought to get up and eat, he fell asleep. Deep in the night, a sound disturbed him.
and he came awake and drew his pistol. It was well on toward morning, he could tell that by the moon, but the sound was new to him. Cautiously he turned over, only to see at once that the source of the sound was Os Frank. He had risen in the night and collected another load of buffalo bones. Now he was heaving him up on the pyramid. The sound that had awakened Augustus was the sound of bones, clicking and rattling as they slid down the sides of the pyramid. Augustus holstered his pistol and walked over to watch the old man.
"You're an unusual fellow, Os," he said. "I guess you just work night and day. You should have partnered up with Woodrow Call. He's as crazy about work as you are. The two of you might own the whole world by now if you'd hooked up."
Os Frank didn't respond. He had emptied the wheelbarrow, and he pushed it up the slope, away from the river. Augustus caught his horse and rode east. On his way, he saw Os Frank again, working under the moonlight. He had plenty to work with, for the plain around was littered with buffalo bones. It looked as if a whole herd had been wiped out, for a road of bones stretched far across the plain. He remembered when he had first come to the high plains, years before. For 2 days he and Call and the rangers had ridden parallel to the great southern buffalo herd, hundreds of thousands of animals slowly grazing north. It had been difficult to sleep at night because the horses were nervous around so many animals. The sounds of the herd were constant. They had ridden for nearly 100 miles and seldom been out of sight of the buffalo. Of course, they had heard that the buffalo were being wiped out, but with the memory of the southern herd so vivid, they had hardly credited the news. Discussing it in Lonesome Dove, they had decided that the reports must be exaggerated, thinned out, maybe, but not wiped out. Thus, the sight of the road of bones stretching over the prairie was a shock. Maybe roads of bones were all that was left. The thought gave the very emptiness of the plains a different feel. With those millions of animals gone, and the Indians mostly gone in their wake, the plains were truly empty, unpeopled and ungrazed. Soon the whites would come, of course, but what he was seeing was a moment between. Not the plains as they had been, or as they would be, but a moment of true emptiness, with thousands of miles of grass resting unused, occupied only by remnants of the buffalo, the Indians, the hunters. Augustus thought they were crazed remnants, mostly like the old man who worked night and day gathering bones to no purpose.
"No wonder you never worked out in Waco, Os," he said, speaking as much to himself as to the old man. Os Frank was not in a talkative mood, or a listening mood either. He had filled his wheelbarrow and was heading back to camp.
"I'm going to the walls to kill that big renegade for you," Augustus said. "Need anything?"
Os Frank stopped, as if thinking it over.
"Wished they'd hadn't killed that dog," he said. "I like that dog. It was them Kiowas that killed it, not the Mexicans. 6 Kiowas.
"Well, I got 6 bullets, Augustus said. "Maybe I'll send the rascals where your dog went."
"Them Kiowas shot Bob's horse," Os added. "That's how come they caught him. Built a fire under him and cooked him. That's their way." Then he lifted his wheelbarrow full of bones and walked off toward the Canadian River. The light was just coming, the plains black in the distance, the sky gray where it met the land. Though dawn was his favorite hour, it was also an hour at which Augustus most keenly felt himself to be a fool. What was it but folly to be riding along the Canadian River alone, easy pickings for an outlaw gang, hungry to boot? A chain of follies had put him there. Call's abrupt decision to become a cattleman and his own decision, equally abrupt, to try and rescue a girl foolish enough to be taken in by Jake Spoone. None of it was sensible. Yet he had to admit that there was something about such follies that he liked. The sensible way, which he had pursued once or twice in his life, had always proved boring, usually within a few days. In his case, it had led to nothing much, just excessive drunkenness and reckless card playing. There was more enterprise and certain follies, it seemed to him. As the sun lit the grass,